the strings, heard the humming almost note. It was the lyre I had seen him with the first day I came. Achilles bent again into the trunk, pulled out a second instrument, and came to join me. He settled it on his knees. The wood was carved and golden and shone with careful keeping. It was my mother's lyre, the one my father had sent as part of my price. Achilles plucked a string. The note rose warm and resonant, sweetly pure. My mother had always pulled her chair close to the bard's when they came, so close my father would scowl and the servants would whisper. I remembered, suddenly, the dark gleam of her eyes in the firelight as she watched the bard's hands. The look on her face was like thirst. Achilles plucked another string, and a note rang out, deeper than the other. His hand reached for a peg, turned it. "That is my mother's lyre," I almost said. The words were in my mouth, and behind them others crowded close. "That is my lyre." But I did not speak. What would he say to such a statement? The lyre was his now. I swallowed, my throat dry. "It is beautiful." "My father gave it to me," he said carelessly. Only the way his fingers held it so gently stopped me from rising in rage. He did not notice.
"You can hold it if you like."
The wood would be smooth and known as my own skin. "No," I said through the ache in my chest. "I will not cry in front of him." He started to say something, but at that moment the teacher entered, a man of indeterminate middle age. He had the calloused hands of a musician and carried his own lyre, carved of dark walnut.
"Who is this?"
he asked. His voice was harsh and loud, a musician but not a singer.
"This is Patroclus," Achilles said. "He does not play, but he will learn." "Not on that instrument."
The man's hand swooped down to pluck the lyre from my hands. Instinctively, my fingers tightened on it. It was not as beautiful as my mother's lyre, but it was still a princely instrument. I did not want to give it up. I did not have to. Achilles had caught him by the wrist, mid-reach.
"Yes, on that instrument, if he likes."
The man was angry, but said no more. Achilles released him, and he sat stiffly.
"Begin," he said.
Achilles nodded and bent over the lyre. I did not have time to wonder about his intervention. His fingers touched the strings, and all my thoughts were displaced. The sound was pure and sweet as water, bright as lemons. It was like no music I had ever heard before. It had warmth as a fire does, a texture and weight like polished ivory. It buoyed and soothed at once. A few hairs slipped forward to hang over his eyes as he played. They were fine as lyre strings themselves, and shone. He stopped, pushed back his hair, and turned to me.
"Now you."
I shook my head, full to spilling. I could not play now, not ever, if I could listen to him instead. "You play," I said. Achilles returned to his strings, and the music rose again. This time he sang also, weaving his own accompaniment with a clear, rich treble. His head fell back a little, exposing his throat, supple and fawn skin soft. A small smile lifted the left corner of his mouth. Without meaning to, I found myself leaning forward. When at last he ceased, my chest felt strangely hollowed. I watched him rise to replace the lyres, close the trunk. He bid farewell to the teacher, who turned and left. It took me a long moment before I came back to myself, to notice he was waiting for me.
"We will go see my father now."
I did not quite trust myself to speak, so I nodded and followed him out of the room and up the twisting hallways to the king. Chapter 5. Achilles stopped me just inside the bronze-studded doors of Peleus's audience chamber.
"Wait here," he said.
Peleus was seated on a high-backed chair at the room's other end. An older man, one I had seen before with Peleus, stood near, as if the two had been in conference. The fire smoked thickly, and the room felt hot and close. The walls were hung with deep-dyed tapestries and old weapons kept gleaming by servants. Achilles walked past them and knelt at his father's feet.
Father, I come to ask your pardon.
Oh?
Peleus lifted an eyebrow.
Speak, then.
From where I stood, his face looked cold and displeased. I was suddenly fearful. We had interrupted. Achilles had not even knocked.
I have taken Patroclus from his drills.
My name sounded strange on his lips. I almost did not recognize it. The old king's brows drew together.
Who?
Menoetiades,
Achilles said. Menoetius's son.
Ah.
Peleus's gaze followed the carpet back to where I stood, trying not to fidget.
Yes, the boy the arms master wants to whip.
Yes, but it is not his fault. I forgot to say I wished him for a companion.
Therapon was the word he used. A brother-in-arms sworn to a prince by blood oaths and love. In war, these men were his honor guard. In peace, his closest advisers. It was a place of highest esteem. Another reason the boys swarmed Peleus's son, showing off. They hoped to be chosen. Peleus's eyes narrowed.
Come here, Patroclus.
The carpet was thick beneath my feet. I knelt a little behind Achilles. I could feel the king's gaze on me.
For many years now, Achilles, I have urged companions on you, and you have turned them away. Why this boy?
The question might have been my own. I had nothing to offer such a prince. Why, then, had he made a charity case of me? Peleus and I both waited for his answer.
He is surprising.
I looked up, frowning. If he thought so, he was the only one.
Surprising, Peleus echoed.
Yes,
Achilles explained no further, though I hoped he would. Peleus rubbed his nose in thought.
The boy is an exile with a stain upon him. He will add no luster to your reputation.
I do not need him to,
Achilles said, not proudly or boastfully, honestly. Peleus acknowledged this.
Yet other boys will be envious that you have chosen such a one. What will you tell them?
I will sell them nothing.
The answer came with no hesitation, clear and crisp.
It is not for them to say what I will do.
I found my pulse beating thickly in my veins, fearing Peleus's anger. It did not come. Father and son met each other's gaze, and the faintest touch of amusement bloomed at the corner of Peleus's mouth.
Stand up, both of you.
I did so, dizzily.
I pronounce your sentence. Achilles, you will give your apology to Amphidamas, and Patroclus will give his as well.
Yes, father.
That is all.
He turned from us, back to his counselor, in dismissal. Outside again, Achilles was brisk.
I will see you at dinner,
he said, and turned to go. An hour before, I would have said I was glad to be rid of him. Now, strangely, I felt stung. Where are you going? He stopped.
Drills.
Alone?
Yes. No one sees me fight.
The words came as if he were used to saying them. Why? He looked at me a long moment, as if weighing something.
My mother has forbidden it, because of the prophecy.
What prophecy? I had not heard of this.
That I will be the best warrior of my generation.
It sounded like something a young child would claim in make-believe, but he said it as simply as if he were giving his name. The question I wanted to ask was, and are you the best? Instead, I stuttered out, when was the prophecy given?
When I was born, just before, Eileithyia came and told it to my mother.
Eileithyia, goddess of childbirth, rumored to preside in person over the birth of half-gods, those whose nativities were too important to be left to chance. I had forgotten. His mother is a goddess. Is this known?
I was tentative, not wanting to press too far.
Some know of it, and some do not. But that is why I go alone.
But he didn't go. He watched me. He seemed to be waiting.
Then I will see you at dinner, I said at last. He nodded and left.
He was already seated when I arrived, wedged at my table amid the usual clatter of boys. I had half expected him not to be, that I had dreamed the morning. As I sat, I met his eyes quickly, almost guiltily, then looked away. My face was flushing, I was sure. My hands felt heavy and awkward as they reached for the food. I was aware of every swallow, every expression on my face. The meal was very good that night, roasted fish dressed with lemon and herbs, fresh cheese and bread, and he ate well. The boys were unconcerned by my presence. They had long ago ceased to see me.
Patroclus?
Achilles did not slur my name as people often did, running it together as if in a hurry to be rid of it. Instead, he rang each syllable. Patroclus. Around us, dinner was ending, the servants clearing the plates. I looked up, and the boys quieted, watching with interest. He did not usually address us by name.
Tonight, you're to sleep in my room, he said.
I was so shocked that my mouth would have hung open, but the boys were there, and I had been raised with a prince's pride. All right, I said.
A servant will bring your things.
I could hear the thoughts of the staring boys as if they said them. Why him? Peleus had spoken true. He had often encouraged Achilles to choose his companions, but in all those years, Achilles showed no special interest in any of the boys, though he was polite to all as befitted his upbringing. And now he had bestowed the long-awaited honor upon the most unlikely of us, small and ungrateful, and probably cursed. He turned to go, and I followed him, trying not to stumble, feeling the eyes of the table on my back. He led me past my old room, and the chamber of state with its high-backed throne. Another turn, and we were in a portion of the palace I did not know, a wing that slanted down towards water. The walls were painted with bright patterns that bled to grey as his torch passed them. His room was so close to the sea that the air tasted of salt. There were no wall pictures here, only plain stone and a single soft rug. The furniture was simple, but well made, carved from dark grain wood I recognized as foreign. Off to one side, I saw a thick pallet. He gestured to it.
That is for you.
Oh. Saying thank you did not seem the right response.
Are you tired?
He asked. No. He nodded, as if I had said something wise.
Me neither.
I nodded in turn, each of us warily polite, bobbing our head like birds. There was a silence.
Do you want to help me juggle?
I don't know how.
You don't have to know. I'll show you.
I was regretting saying I was not tired. I did not want to make a fool of myself in front of him. But his face was hopeful, and I felt like a miser to refuse.
All right. How many can you hold?
I don't know.
Show me your hand.
I did, palm out. He rested his own palm against it. I tried not to startle. His skin was soft and slightly sticky from dinner. The plump finger pads brushing mine were very warm.
About the same. It will be better to start with two, then. Take these.
He reached for six leather-covered balls, the type that mummers used. Obediently, I claimed two.
When I say, throw one to me.
Normally I would chafe at being bossed this way, but somehow the words did not sound like commands in his mouth. He began to juggle the remaining balls.
Now,
he said. I let the ball fly from my hand towards him, saw it pulled seamlessly into the circling blur.
Again,
he said. I threw another ball and it joined the others.
You do that well,
he said. I looked up quickly. Was he mocking me? But his face was sincere.
Catch.
A ball came back to me, just like the fig at dinner.
My part took no great skill, but I enjoyed it anyway. We found ourselves smiling at the satisfaction of each smooth catch and throw. After some time, he stopped, yawned.
"It's late," he said.
I was surprised to see the moon high outside the window. I had not noticed the minutes passing. I sat on the pallet and watched as he busied himself with the tasks of bed, washing his face with water from a wide-mouthed ewer, untying the bit of leather that bound his hair. The silence brought my uneasiness back. Why was I here? Achilles snuffed out the torch.
"Good night," he said.
"Good night." The word felt strange in my mouth, like another language. Time passed. In the moonlight, I could just make out the shape of his face, sculptor perfect across the room. His lips were parted slightly, an arm thrown carelessly above his head. He looked different in sleep, beautiful, but cold as moonlight. I found myself wishing he would awake, so that I might watch the life return. The next morning, after breakfast, I went back to the boys' room, expecting to find my things returned. They were not, and I saw that my bed had been stripped of its linens. I checked again after lunch, and after spear practice, and then again before bed, but my old place remained empty and unmade. So, still. Warily, I made my way to his room, half expecting a servant to stop me. None did. In the doorway of his room, I hesitated. He was within, lounging as I had seen him that first day, one leg dangling.
"Hello,"
he said. If he had shown any hesitation or surprise, I would have left, gone back and slept on the bare reeds rather than stay here. But he did not. There was only his easy tone and a sharp attention in his eyes.
"Hello,"
I answered, and went to take my place on the cot across the room. Slowly, I grew used to it. I no longer startled when he spoke, no longer waited for rebuke. I stopped expecting to be sent away. After dinner, my feet took me to his room out of habit, and I thought of the pallet where I lay as mine. At night, I still dreamed of the dead boy, but when I woke, sweaty and terror-stricken, the moon would be bright on the water outside, and I could hear the lick of the waves against the shore. In the dim light I saw his easy breathing, the drowsy tangle of his limbs. In spite of myself, my pulse slowed. There was a vividness to him, even at rest, that made death and spirit seem foolish. After a time, I found I could sleep again. Time after that, the dreams lessened and dropped away. I learned that he was not so dignified as he looked. Beneath his poise and stillness was another face, full of mischief and faceted like a gem catching the light. He liked to play games against his own skill, catching things with his eyes closed, setting himself impossible leaps over beds and chairs. When he smiled, the skin at the corners of his eyes crinkled like a leaf held to flame. He was like a flame himself. He glittered, drew eyes. There was a glamour to him, even on waking with his hair tousled and his face still muddled with sleep. Up close, his feet looked almost unearthly, the perfectly formed pads of the toes, the tendons that flickered like lyre strings. The heels were calloused, white over pink from going everywhere barefoot. His father made him rub them with oils that smelled of sandalwood and pomegranate. He began to tell me the stories of his day before we drifted off to sleep. At first I only listened, but after time my tongue loosened. I began to tell my own stories, first of the palace, and later small bits from before. The skipping stones, the wooden horse I had played with, the lyre from my mother's dowry.
"I'm glad your father sent it with you," he said.
Soon our conversation spilled out of the night's confinement. I surprised myself with how much there was to say, about everything, the beach and dinner and one boy or another. I stopped watching for ridicule, the scorpion's tail hidden in his words. He said what he meant. He was puzzled if you did not.
Some people might have mistaken this for simplicity. But is it not a sort of genius to cut always to the heart? One afternoon, as I went to leave him to his private drills, he said, "Why don't you come with me?" His voice was a little strained. If I had not thought it impossible, I might have said he was nervous. The air, which had grown comfortable between us, felt suddenly taut. "All right," I said. It was the quiet hours of late afternoon. The palace slept out the heat and left us alone. We took the longest way, through the olive grove's twisting path to the house where the arms were kept. I stood in the doorway as he selected his practice weapons, a spear and a sword, slightly blunted at the tip. I reached for my own, then hesitated. "Should I?" He shook his head. "No. I do not fight with others," he told me. I followed him outside to the packed sand circle. "Never?"
"No."
"Then how do you know that?" I trailed off as he took up a stance in the center, his spear in his hand, his sword at his waist.
"That the prophecy is true? Guess I don't."
"Divine blood flows differently in each god-born child. Orpheus's voice made the trees weep. Heracles could kill a man by clapping him on the back. Achilles' miracle was his speed. His spear, as he began the first pass, moved faster than my eye could follow. It whirled, flashing forward, reversed, then flashed behind. The shaft seemed to flow in his hands. The dark gray point flickered like a snake's tongue. His feet beat the ground like a dancer, never still. I could not move, watching. I almost did not breathe. His face was calm and blank, not tensed with effort. His movements were so precise, I could almost see the men he fought, 10, 20 of them, advancing on all sides. He leapt, scything his spear, even as his other hand snatched the sword from its sheath. He swung out with them both, moving like liquid, like a fish through the waves. He stopped suddenly. I could hear his breaths, only a little louder than usual in the still afternoon air. "Who trained you?" I asked. I did not know what else to say.
"My father, a little."
A little. I felt almost frightened. "No one else?"
"No."
I stepped forward. "Fight me." He made a sound almost like a laugh.
"No, of course not."
"Fight me." I felt in a trance. He had been trained, a little, by his father. The rest was, what, divine? This was more of the gods than I had ever seen in my life. He made it look beautiful, this sweating, hacking art of ours. I understood why his father did not let him fight in front of the others. How could any ordinary man take pride in his own skill when there was this in the world?
"I don't want to."
"I dare you."
"You don't have any weapons."
"I'll get them." He knelt and laid his weapons in the dirt. His eyes met mine.
"I will not. Do not ask me again."
"I will ask you again. You cannot forbid me." I stepped forward, defiant. Something burned hot in me now, an impatience, a certainty. I would have this thing. He would give it to me. His face twisted, and almost I thought I saw anger. This pleased me. I would goad him if nothing else. He would fight me then. My nerves sang with the danger of it. But instead, he walked away, his weapons abandoned in the dust.
"Come back," I said.
Then louder,
"Come back. Are you afraid?"
That strange half-laugh again, his back still turned.
"No, I'm not afraid." "You should be."
I meant it as a joke, an easing, but it did not sound that way in the still air that hung between us. His back stared at me, unmoving, unmovable. I will make him look at me, I thought. My legs swallowed up the 5 steps between us, and I crashed into his back. He stumbled forward, falling, and I clung to him. We landed, and I heard the quick huff of his breath as it was driven from him.
But before I could speak, he was twisting around beneath me, had seized my wrists in his hands. I struggled, not sure what I had meant to do, but here was resistance, and that was something I could fight. "Let me go!" I yanked my wrists against his grip.
"No!"
In a swift motion, he rolled me beneath him, pinning me, his knees in my belly. I panted, angry but strangely satisfied. "I have never seen anyone fight the way you do," I told him. Confession or accusation or both.
"You have not seen much."
I bridled, despite the mildness of his tone. "You know what I mean." His eyes were unreadable. Over us both, the unripe olives rattled gently.
"Maybe. What do you mean?"
I twisted hard, and he let go. We sat up, our tunics dusty and stuck to our backs. "I mean," I broke off. There was an edge to me now, that familiar keenness of anger and envy, struck to life like flint. But the bitter words died even as I thought them. "There is no one like you," I said at last. He regarded me a moment in silence.
"So?"
Something in the way he spoke it drained the last of my anger from me. I had minded once, but who was I now to begrudge such a thing? As if he heard me, he smiled, and his face was like the sun. Chapter 6. Our friendship came all at once after that, like spring floods from the mountains. Before, the boys and I had imagined that his days were filled with princely instruction, statecraft, and spear. But I had long since learned the truth. Other than his lyre lessons and his drills, he had no instruction. One day we might go swimming, another we might climb trees. We made up games for ourselves of racing and tumbling. We would lie on the warm sand and say, "Guess what I'm thinking about?" The falcon we had seen from our window, the boy with the crooked front tooth, dinner. And as we swam, or played, or talked, a feeling would come. It was almost like fear in the way it filled me, rising in my chest. It was almost like tears in how swiftly it came. But it was neither of those. Buoyant where they were heavy, bright where they were dull. I had known contentment before. Brief snatches of time in which I pursued solitary pleasure, skipping stones or dicing or dreaming. But in truth, it had been less a presence than an absence, a laying aside of dread. My father was not near, nor boys. I was not hungry or tired or sick. This feeling was different. I found myself grinning until my cheeks hurt, my scalp prickling till I thought it might lift off my head. My tongue ran away from me, giddy with freedom. "This and this and this," I said to him. I did not have to fear that I spoke too much. I did not have to worry that I was too slender or too slow. "This and this and this." I taught him how to skip stones, and he taught me how to carve wood. I could feel every nerve in my body, every brush of air against my skin. He played my mother's lyre, and I watched. When it was my turn to play, my fingers tangled in the strings and the teacher despaired of me. I did not care. "Play again," I told him. And he played until I could barely see his fingers in the dark. I saw then how I had changed. I did not mind any more that I lost when we raced and I lost when we swam out to the rocks and I lost when we tossed spears or skipped stones. For who can be ashamed to lose to such beauty? It was enough to watch him win, to see the soles of his feet flashing as they kicked up sand, or the rise and fall of his shoulders as he pulled through the salt. It was enough. It was late summer, over a year after my exile had begun, when at last I told him of how I had killed the boy. We were in the branches of the courtyard oak, hidden by the patchwork leaves. It was easier here somehow. Off the ground, with the solid trunk at my back. He listened silently, and when I had finished, he asked,
"Why did you not say that you were defending yourself?"
It was like him to ask this, the thing I had not thought of before. I don't know.
Well, you could have lied. Said you found him already dead.
I stared at him, stunned by the simplicity of it. I could have lied. And then the revelation that followed. If I had lied, I would still be a prince. It was not murder that had exiled me, it was my lack of cunning. I understood now. The disgust in my father's eyes, his moron son confessing all. I recalled how his jaw had hardened as I spoke. He does not deserve to be a king. You would not have lied, I said.
No,
he admitted. What would you have done? I asked. Achilles tapped a finger against the branch he sat on.
I don't know. I can't imagine it. The way the boy spoke to you,
he shrugged.
No one has ever tried to take something from me.
Never. I could not believe it. A life without such things seemed impossible.
Never.
He was silent a moment, thinking.
I don't know, he repeated finally. I think I would be angry.
He closed his eyes and rested his head back against a branch. The green oak leaves crowded around his hair like a crown. I saw King Peleus often now. We were called to councils sometimes, and dinners with visiting kings. I was allowed to sit at the table beside Achilles, even to speak if I wished. I did not wish. I was happy to be silent and watch the men around me. Scops, Peleus took to calling me, owl for my big eyes. He was good at this sort of affection, general and unbinding. After the men were gone, we would sit with him by the fire to hear the stories of his youth. The old man, now grey and faded, told us that he had once fought beside Heracles. When I said that I had seen Philoctetes, he smiled.
Yes, the bearer of Heracles' great bow. Back then he was a spearman and much the bravest of us.
This was like him, too, these sorts of compliments. I understood now how his treasury had come to be so full of the gifts of treaty and alliance. Among our bragging, ranting heroes, Peleus was the exception, a man of modesty. We stayed to listen as the servants added one log and then another to the flames. It was halfway to dawn before he would send us back to our beds. The only place I did not follow was to see his mother. He went late at night, or at dawn before the palace was awake, and returned flushed and smelling of the sea. When I asked about it, he told me freely, his voice strangely toneless.
It is always the same. She wants to know what I am doing, and if I am well. She speaks to me of my reputation among men. At the end, she asks if I will come with her.
I was rapt. Where?
The caves under the sea.
Where the sea nymphs lived, so deep the sun did not penetrate.
Will you go?
He shook his head.
My father says I should not. He says no mortal who sees them comes back the same.
When he turned away, I made the peasant sign against evil. Gods avert. It frightened me a little to hear him speak of a thing so calmly. Gods and mortals never mixed happily in our stories. But she was his mother, I reassured myself, and he was half god himself. In time, his visits with her were just another strangeness about him that I became accustomed to, like the marvel of his feet or the inhuman deftness of his fingers. When I heard him climbing back through the window at dawn, I would mumble from my bed, "Is she well?" And he would answer,
"Yes, she is well."
And he might add,
"The fish are thick today,"
or
"The bay is warm as a bath."
And then we would sleep again. One morning of my second spring, he came back from his visit with his mother later than usual. The sun was almost out of the water, and the goat bells were clanging in the hills.
"Is she well?"
"She is well. She wants to meet you."
I felt a surge of fear, but stifled it.
"Do you think I should?"
I could not imagine what she would want with me. I knew her reputation for hating mortals. He did not meet my eyes. His fingers turned a stone he had found over and over.
There is no harm in it. Tomorrow night, she said.
I understood now that it was a command. The gods did not make requests. I knew him well enough to see that he was embarrassed. He was never so stiff with me.
Tomorrow?
He nodded. I did not want him to see my fear, though normally we kept nothing from each other. Should I bring a gift? Honeyed wine? We poured it over the altars of the gods on festival days. It was one of our richest offerings. He shook his head.
She doesn't like it.
The next night, when the household slept, I climbed out of our window. The moon was half full, bright enough for me to pick my way over the rocks without a torch. He had said that I was to stand in the surf, and she would come. No, he had reassured me. You do not need to speak. She will know. The waves were warm and thick with sand. I shifted, watched the small white crabs run through the surf. I was listening, thinking I might hear the splash of her feet as she approached. A breeze blew down the beach and, grateful, I closed my eyes to it. When I opened them again, she was standing before me. She was taller than I was, taller than any woman I had ever seen. Her black hair was loose down her back, and her skin shone luminous and impossibly pale, as if it drank light from the moon. She was so close I could smell her, seawater laced with dark brown honey. I did not breathe. I did not dare.
You are Patroclus.
I flinched at the sound of her voice, hoarse and rasping. I had expected chimes, not the grinding of rocks in the surf. Yes, lady. Distaste ran over her face. Her eyes were not like a human's. They were black to their center and flecked with gold. I could not bring myself to meet them.
He will be a god, she said.
I did not know what to say, so I said nothing. She leaned forward, and I half thought she might touch me, but of course she did not.
Do you understand?
I could feel her breath on my cheek, not warm at all, but chilled like the depths of the sea. Do you understand? He had told me that she hated to be kept waiting. Yes. She leaned closer still, looming over me. Her mouth was a gash of red, like the torn open stomach of a sacrifice, bloody and oracular. Behind it, her teeth shone sharp and white as bone.
Good.
Carelessly, as if to herself, she added,
You will be dead soon enough.
She turned and dove into the sea, leaving no ripples behind her. I did not go straight back to the palace. I could not. I went to the olive grove instead, to sit among the twisting trunks and fallen fruits. It was far from the sea. I did not wish to smell the salt now. You will be dead soon enough. She had said it coldly as a fact. She did not wish me for his companion, but I was not worth killing. To a goddess, the few decades of human life were barely even an inconvenience. She wished him to be a god. She had spoken it so simply, as if it were obvious. A god. I could not imagine him so. Gods were cold and distant, far off as the moon, nothing like his bright eyes. The warm mischief of his smiles. Her desire was ambitious. It was a difficult thing to make even a half-god immortal. True, it had happened before, to Heracles and Orpheus and Orion. They sat in the sky now, presiding as constellations, feasting with the gods on ambrosia. But these men had been the sons of Zeus, their sinews strong with the purest ichor that flowed. Thetis was a lesser of the lesser gods, a sea nymph only. In our stories, these divinities had to work by wheedling and flattery, by favors won from stronger gods. They could not do much themselves, except live forever.
What are you thinking about?
It was Achilles,
come to find me. His voice was loud in the quiet grove, but I did not startle. I had half expected him to come. I had wanted him to. Nothing, I said. It was untrue. I guess it always is. He sat down beside me, his feet bare and dusty.
Did she tell you that you would die soon?
I turned to look at him, startled. Yes, I said.
I'm sorry, he said.
The wind blew the grey leaves above us, and somewhere I heard the soft pat of an olive fall. She wants you to be a god, I told him.
I know.
His face twisted with embarrassment, and in spite of itself my heart lightened. It was such a boyish response, and so human. Parents everywhere. But the question still waited to be asked. I could do nothing until I knew the answer. Do you want to be? I paused, struggling, though I had promised myself I wouldn't. I had sat in the grove practicing this very question as I waited for him to find me. Do you want to be a god? His eyes were dark in the half-light. I could not make out the gold flecks in the green.
I don't know, he said at last. I don't know what it means or how it happens.
He looked down at his hands, clasping his knees.
I don't want to leave here. When would it happen, anyway? Soon?
I was at a loss. I knew nothing of how gods were made. I was mortal only. He was frowning now, his voice louder.
And is there really a place like that? Olympus? She doesn't even know how she will do it. She pretends she knows. She thinks, if I become famous enough...
He trailed off. This, at least, I could follow. Then the gods will take you voluntarily. He nodded, but he had not answered my question. Achilles. He turned to me, his eyes still filled with frustration, with a sort of angry bewilderment. He was barely 12. Do you want to be a god? It was easier this time.
Not yet, he said.
A tightness I had not known was there eased a little. I would not lose him yet. He cupped a hand against his chin. His features looked finer than usual, like carved marble.
I'd like to be a hero, though. I think I could do it. If the prophecy is true, if there's a war. My mother says I'm better even than Heracles was.
I did not know what to say to this. I did not know if it was motherly bias or fact. I did not care. Not yet. He was silent a moment, then turned to me, suddenly.
Would you want to be a god?
There, among the moss and olives, it struck me as funny. I laughed, and, a moment later, he did too. I do not think that is likely, I told him. I stood, put down a hand for him. He took it, pulled himself up. Our tunics were dusty, and my feet tingled slightly with drying sea salt.
There were figs in the kitchen. I saw them, he said.
We were only 12, too young to brood.
I bet I can eat more than you.
Race you.
I laughed. We ran. Chapter 7. The next summer, we turned 13. Him first, and then me. Our bodies began to stretch, pulling at our joints till they were aching and weak. In Peleus's shining bronze mirror, I almost did not recognize myself. Lanky and gaunt, stork legs and sharpening chin. Achilles was taller still, seeming to tower above me. Eventually, we would be of a height, but he came to his maturity sooner, with a startling speed, primed perhaps by the divinity in his blood. The boys, too, were growing older. Regularly now we heard moans behind closed doors and saw shadows returning to their beds before dawn. In our countries, a man often took a wife before his beard was fully fledged. How much earlier, then, did he take a serving girl? It was expected. Very few men came to their marriage beds without having done so. Those who did were unlucky indeed, too weak to compel, too ugly to charm, and too poor to pay.
It was customary for a palace to have a full complement of nobly born women as servants for the mistress of the house. But Peleus had no wife in the palace, and so the women we saw were mostly slaves. They had been brought or taken in warfare, or bred from those who were. During the day, they poured wine and scrubbed floors and kept the kitchen. At night, they belonged to soldiers or foster boys, to visiting kings or Peleus himself. The swollen bellies that followed were not a thing of shame. They were profit, more slaves. These unions were not always rape. Sometimes there was mutual satisfaction and even affection. At least, that is what the men who spoke of them believed. It would have been easy, infinitely easy, for Achilles or me to have bedded one of these girls ourselves. At 13, we were almost late to do so, especially him, as princes were known for their appetites. Instead, we watched in silence as the foster boys pulled girls onto their laps, or Peleus summoned the prettiest to his room after dinner. Once, I even heard the king offer her to his son. He answered, almost diffidently, "I'm tired tonight." Later, as we walked back to our room, he avoided my eyes. And I? I was shy and silent with all but Achilles. I could scarcely speak to the other boys, let alone a girl. As a comrade of the prince, I suppose I would not have had to speak. A gesture or a look would have been enough. But such a thing did not occur to me. The feelings that stirred in me at night seemed strangely distant from those serving girls with their lowered eyes and obedience. I watched a boy fumbling at a girl's dress, the dull look on her face as she poured his wine. I did not wish for such a thing. One night, we had stayed late in Peleus's chamber. Achilles was on the floor, an arm thrown beneath his head for a pillow. I sat more formally in a chair. It was not just because of Peleus. I did not like the sprawling length of my new limbs. The old king's eyes were half closed. He was telling us a story.
Meleager was the finest warrior of his day, but also the proudest. He expected the best of everything, and because the people loved him, he received it.
My eyes drifted to Achilles. His fingers were stirring, just barely, in the air. He often did this when he was composing a new song. The story of Meleager, I guessed, as his father told it.
But one day, the king of Caledon said, "Why must we give so much to Meleager? There are other worthy men in Caledon."
Achilles shifted, and his tunic pulled tight across his chest. That day, I had overheard a serving girl whispering to her friend, "Do you think the prince looked at me at dinner?" Her tone was one of hope.
Meleager heard the words of the king and was enraged.
This morning, he had leapt onto my bed and pressed his nose against mine.
"Good morning,"
he'd said. I remembered the heat of him against my skin.
"He said, 'I will not fight for you any longer.' And he went back to his house and sought comfort in the arms of his wife."
I felt a tug on my foot. It was Achilles grinning at me from the floor.
"Caledon had fierce enemies, and when they heard that Meleager would no longer fight for Caledon..."
I pushed my foot towards him a little, provokingly, his fingers wrapped around my ankle.
"They attacked, and the city of Caledon suffered terrible losses."
Achilles yanked, and I slid half out of the chair. I clung to the wooden frame so I would not be pulled onto the floor.
"So the people went to Meleager to beg him for his help. And, Achilles, are you listening?"
"Yes, father."
"You are not. You are tormenting our poor scops."
I tried to look tormented, but all I felt was the coolness against my ankle where his fingers had been a moment before.
"It is just as well, perhaps. I am getting tired. We will finish the story another evening."
We stood and wished the old man good night. But as we turned, he said,
"Achilles, you might look for the light-haired girl from the kitchen. She has been haunting doorways for you, I hear.
It was hard to know if it was the firelight that made his face look so changed.
Perhaps, Father. I am tired tonight.
Pelias chuckled, as if this were a joke.
I'm sure she could wake you up.
He waved us off. I had to trot a little to keep up with him as we walked back to our rooms. We washed our faces in silence, but there was an ache in me, like a rotten tooth. I could not let it be.
That girl. Do you like her?
Achilles turned to face me from across the room.
Why? Do you?
No, no, I flushed. That is not what I meant. I had not felt so uncertain with him since the earliest days.
I mean, do you want...
He ran at me, pushed me backwards onto my cot, leaned over me.
I'm sick of talking about her, he said.
The heat rose up my neck, wrapped fingers over my face. His hair fell around me, and I could smell nothing but him. The grain of his lips seemed to rest a hair's breadth from mine. Then, just like that morning, he was gone, up across the room and pouring a last cup of water. His face was still and calm.
Good night,
he said. At night, in bed, images come. They begin as dreams, trailing caresses in my sleep from which I start, trembling. I lie awake, and still they come, the flicker of firelight on a neck, the curve of a hip bone drawing downwards. Hands, smooth and strong, reaching to touch me. I know those hands, but even here, behind the darkness of my eyelids, I cannot name the thing I hope for. During the days I grow restless, fidgety, but all my pacing, singing, running does not help keep them at bay. They come and will not be stopped. It is summer, one of the first fine days. We are on the beach after lunch, our backs to a sloping piece of driftwood. The sun is high and the air warm around us. Beside me, Achilles shifts, and his foot falls open against mine. It is cool and chafed pink from the sand, soft from a winter indoors. He hums something, a piece of a song he had played earlier. I turn to look at him. His face is smooth, without the blotches and spots that have begun to afflict the other boys. His features are drawn with a firm hand, nothing awry or sloppy, nothing too large, all precise, cut with the sharpest of knives. And yet, the effect itself is not sharp. He turns and finds me looking at him.
What?
He says.
Nothing.
I can smell him. The oils that he uses on his feet, pomegranate and sandalwood. The salt of clean sweat. The hyacinths we had walked through, their scent crushed against our ankles. Beneath it all is his own smell, the one I go to sleep with. The one I wake up to. I cannot describe it. It is sweet, but not just. It is strong, but not too strong. Something like almond, but that still is not right. Sometimes, after we have wrestled, my own skin smells like it. He puts a hand down to lean against. The muscles in his arms curve softly, appearing and disappearing as he moves. His eyes are deep green on mine. My pulse jumps, for no reason I can name. He has looked at me a thousand, thousand times, but there is something different in this gaze, an intensity I do not know. My mouth is dry, and I can hear the sound of my throat as I swallow. He watches me. It seems that he is waiting. I shift, an infinitesimal movement, towards him. It is like the leap from a waterfall. I do not know, until then, what I am going to do. I lean forward, and our lips land clumsily on each other. They are like the fat bodies of bees, soft and round and giddy with pollen. I can taste his mouth, hot and sweet with honey from dessert. My stomach trembles, and a warm drop of pleasure spreads beneath my skin. More. The strength of my desire,
The speed with which it flowers shocks me. I flinch and startle back from him. I have a moment, only a moment, to see his face framed in the afternoon light, his lips slightly parted, still half forming a kiss. His eyes are wide with surprise. I am horrified. What have I done? But I do not have time to apologize. He stands and steps backwards. His face is closed over, impenetrable and distant, freezing the explanations in my mouth. He turns and races, the fastest boy in the world, up the beach and away. My side is cold with his absence. My skin feels tight, and my face, I know, is red and raw as a burn. Dear gods, I think, let him not hate me. I should have known better than to call upon the gods. When I turned the corner onto the garden path, she was there, sharp and knife-bright. A blue dress clung to her skin as if damp. Her dark eyes held mine, and her fingers, chill and unearthly pale, reached for me. My feet knocked against each other as she lifted me from the earth.
"I have seen,"
she hissed, the sound of waves breaking on stone. I could not speak. She held me by the throat.
"He is leaving."
Her eyes were black now, dark as sea-wet rocks and as jagged.
"I should have sent him long ago. Do not try to follow."
I could not breathe now, but I did not struggle. That much, at least, I knew. She seemed to pause, and I thought she might speak again. She did not, only opened her hand and released me, boneless to the ground. A mother's wishes. In our countries, they were not worth much, but she was a goddess, first and always. When I returned to the room, it was already dark. I found Achilles sitting on his bed, staring at his feet. His head lifted, almost hopefully, as I came to the doorway. I did not speak. His mother's black eyes still burned in front of me, and the sight of his heels flashing up the beach. "Forgive me. It was a mistake. This is what I might have dared to say then, if it had not been for her." I came into the room, sat on my own bed. He shifted, his eyes flicking to mine. He did not resemble her the way that children normally look like a parent's. A tilt of chin, the shape of an eye. It was something in his movements, in his luminous skin. Son of a goddess. What had I thought would happen? Even from where I sat, I could smell the sea on him.
"I'm supposed to leave tomorrow," he said.
It was almost an accusation. "Oh," I said. My mouth felt swollen and numb, too thick to form words.
"I'm going to be taught by Chiron."
He paused, then added,
"He taught Heracles and Perseus."
Not yet, he had said to me, but his mother had chosen differently. He stood and pulled off his tunic. It was hot, full summer, and we were accustomed to sleeping naked. The moon shone on his belly, smooth, muscled, downed with light brown hairs that darkened as they ran below his waist. I averted my eyes. The next morning, at dawn, he rose and dressed. I was awake. I had not slept. I watched him through the fringes of my eyelids, feigning sleep. From time to time he glanced at me. In the dim half-light, his skin glowed grey and smooth as marble. He slung his bag over his shoulder and paused, a last time at the door. I remember him there, outlined in the stone frame, his hair falling loose, still untidy from sleep. I closed my eyes, and a moment passed. When I opened them again, I was alone. Chapter 8. By breakfast, everyone knew he was gone. Their glances and whispers followed me to the table, lingered as I reached for food. I chewed and swallowed. Though the bread sat like a stone in my stomach, I yearned to be away from the palace. I wanted the air. I walked to the olive grove, the earth dry beneath my feet. I half wondered if I was expected to join the boys now that he was gone. I half wondered if anyone would notice whether I did. I half hoped they would. Whip me, I thought. I could smell the sea. It was everywhere, in my hair, in my clothes, in the sticky damp of my skin. Even here in the grove, amidst the must of leaves and earth,